For many of us, when we think about psychotherapy and making therapy better, we think about zooming in on the therapist's office, that therapeutic encounter that many of us hold almost sacred. But every one of these encounters exists within a much larger ecosystem of barriers and opportunities, the availability of therapists, the changing ways in which care is delivered, and the broader societal patterns of stressors and the ways in which distress manifests in people's lives and either brings them to psychotherapy or not. In many ways, the personal story of psychotherapy can't be fully understood without also looking at this population-level story of mental health services. Well, today's guest, Dr. Mark Olfson, has devoted much of his career to telling just that story. Mark is professor of clinical psychiatry at Columbia University and a practicing psychiatrist at the New York State Psychiatric Institute. Mark's also one of the most prolific researchers on mental health services in the United States. In this episode, Bruce sits down with Dr. Olfson to explore how the COVID-19 pandemic reshaped mental health and mental health services in America, the rise of teletherapy and what that means for equity and access, and how shifts in the workforce are changing who delivers psychotherapy. So let's dive into this timely conversation between Drs. Bruce Wampold and Mark Olfson. As always, please like and subscribe this video. It really helps us out, and we're just so happy you're along for the ride. Stay tuned for more content just as soon as we can get it out.
Okay, so we'll jump into it. So Mark, it's great to have you on the podcast today. You know, we've spent a lot of time interviewing therapists about the intricacies of psychotherapy. How does it work? How do they conduct therapy? What are the factors that lead to success? So your expertise, you and your colleagues have written much about the epidemiology of mental disorders and the availability of treatment in large national surveys. So it's really exciting to talk about that aspect of mental health services because it's really important, I think, for all of us to understand the context in which we're working. So I'm going to jump in and talk about the idea. We've just been through a pandemic. The COVID pandemic changed much in our lives personally, but it changed much about both the prevalence of mental disorders and the treatment. So let's talk with prevalence. Your surveys, anecdotal reports indicate that people are suffering more distress as a result of the pandemic, perhaps both the disease, but also the consequences of the lockdown and the restrictions. So talk for a few minutes, if you would, about prevalence. What are the trends, both during the pandemic and now that the pandemic is over?
Sure. Well, thank you. And it's nice to be here with you, Bruce. So yes, the pandemic clearly coincided with an increase in the prevalence of common mental disorders in the United States. See rising rates of depression and anxiety and nonspecific mental health problems, all of them becoming more prevalent during than before the pandemic. And as you indicate, you know, a lot of factors have been implicated: fear and grief, the morbidity, physical morbidity related to the virus itself, social restrictions and isolation, all the financial uncertainty, all the disruptions in routines and work, all of them contributing to background distress that is, I'm sure, appearing, you know, in offices as mental health concerns of various kinds. Now, since the pandemic has ended, which officially didn't occur until May of 2023, but I think occurred a lot earlier functionally for many of us, we have seen there's been a decrease since the peak, during the spring of 2020 in mid-March. But we have also seen during 2023 and 2024, we've seen evidence of increasing prescriptions of antidepressants and increasing reports of depressive symptoms. So there's some evidence of just over the last couple of years, more gradual increases, not at, at the level, though, that we saw during the peak of the pandemic.
So we're facing increased prevalence of mental disorders. Let's talk a little bit about treatment. Have we responded with greater availability of treatment in response to this need? And, you know, as clearly we've changed modalities because more treatment is being offered electronically through teletherapy. So where are we in the treatment side of this equation?
Yeah, well, that's actually a very important aspect. So use of mental health services, you know, especially for younger adults, was increasing slowly before the onset of the pandemic. And then during the pandemic, there's like an inflection point. It really began to accelerate in its increase. And so we've seen that, you know, over the past few years, we've seen a substantial rise. And approximately half of the people who are receiving psychotherapy are receiving one or more of their visits via telehealth, like as you indicate. And many of them, about a quarter of them, are fully remote. And that's brand new and has, I think, been one of the driving factors in the overall increase in mental health and outpatient mental health care in the United States, and particularly for psychotherapy. And, you know, with these shifting modalities, we have seen some changes in the composition of who's coming for care. So we've seen particularly large increases in treatment for younger adults, those with higher educations, greater family income, private insurance, those who live in cities, and to some extent, those who have low or moderate levels of distress. So there's this issue of the distribution, particularly of telemental health care and teletherapy across these different socio-demographic characteristics. And that in turn raises questions about equitable and, you know, the equitable access to promising modalities like outpatient mental health care. One way of thinking about it is the people that have more resources and who may be in a position of choosing between in-person care and telehealth are opting for telehealth. It, you know, can save them time in terms of commuting. It may be more private, more convenient, and so forth. So the different sort of, you can view it through that lens, I guess, as well. But it certainly represents a substantial change.
Right, but change. This is really interesting because many of us thought that telehealth would provide access to underserved populations, people that have difficulty, let's say, with transportation, childcare. It's rural areas without mental health providers, that the teletherapy and telemental health would open up access. But your findings of the surveys indicate the opposite.
That's right. That's exactly right. It's sort of been turned on its head. There is a literature of telehealth going back before the pandemic, and it is just as you say. It was developed for to try to reach people who are geographically more isolated. And, you know, most counties in the United States don't have a single licensed mental health professional. You know, I live in New York City, and it's easy for me to forget that, you can find a mental health therapist on every block, it seems. But that's not true across America. And telehealth played a small but important role in bridging that gap. But in today's world, it's sort of, as you indicate, it's been flipped on its head, and it's being most widely used by people who are urban and who are, you know, as I mentioned, who are more educated and more well-educated and kind of more savvy in their use of mental health care are choosing it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we don't know the answer to this, but we could speculate about what are the challenges for various populations in teletherapy? I mean, what is it that's standing in the way of greater utilization by those very populations you're talking about, lower income, rural, and so forth?
Yeah, you know, we don't know. One of the other groups that's sort of been left behind are older people, where there may be some digital literacy challenges. You know, young people, this is how they communicate. So that it's a natural for them to take to teletherapy. In certain remote areas, there isn't access to broadband. And so there are technical challenges there. And a lot of we tend to forget, and not so much in psychotherapy, but mental health care, a lot of it is still delivered in primary care, by primary care physicians writing prescriptions for antidepressants. And many of them, because of other things they do that require patients to be there in person, they're not set up for telehealth care. So a chunk of America's mental health care for people that are getting medications, not necessarily getting psychotherapy, is being left behind this sort of revolution in the delivery of mental health.
So the challenges for telemental health, both on the psychotherapy side, but also on the medication.
Right. If anything, yeah. I think the challenges are greater on the medication side.
I know anecdotally, privacy is a concern. People who live in high-density environments, it's hard to have a private conversation. And so to have a teletherapy appointment for an hour in what could be a dense or chaotic environment is difficult.
That's true. It's also true, I think, for college students who are living in dorms and so forth. They may not have access to a private space where they can be comfortable and communicate privately with their therapist.
So one of the trends you mentioned is concerning, and that is that the use of teletherapy, and I think therapy in general, is becoming more widely used by mild and moderately distressed individuals. Now, we're not saying that's necessarily a negative observation, but the severely mentally ill are not commensurately showing an increase in the availability of services.
Yeah, that's true. And I think that still for them, a lot of their care is still being based in organized mental health clinics rather than in private offices. We've also seen at the same time another important trend. We've seen a big rise in the delivery of mental health care, particularly psychotherapy, by licensed mental health counselors. So there's no way that you could have the sort of 30% or so increase that we've seen in psychotherapy just with the existing workforce. So that's another thing that's happened during the COVID pandemic, and that seems to be surviving it, is that there's been a change in who's delivering care. And many of these people may not be well-trained in the delivery of services for people with more serious mental illnesses. So I think that may be another factor that's resulting in it being more challenging to bring these benefits to the higher need population.
Yeah, interesting. Let's delve into that a little bit more, because who's delivering psychotherapy is an interesting phenomenon that I think was changing before the pandemic. So who's delivering psychotherapy, and how has it changed in the last decade or two?
Yeah, so if you back up a few decades, one of the people who's sort of increasingly missing from the story are people like me, people who are psychiatrists. And they have really cut back, I think primarily for financial reasons, because just on a sheer number of patients they can see during the course of the day, they can hit their income targets by medication management. So there's been a real loss there. And as a result, people who are getting medications and getting psychotherapy, many more of them are now receiving split treatment, where they're receiving psychotherapy from a psychotherapist and their medications are being managed by a psychiatrist. So that's a piece of the story. But another piece of the story is, as I mentioned, these Mental health counselors, these aren't people who are trained as psychologists, and they've some of them work for some of the big companies that have sprung up, like Ginger and others, that offer only telehealth services. And so that's another change, is that, you know, and telehealth, I think it is a different thing if it's layered onto care that has a foundation that was in person, versus if, you know, it's a geographically remote who has no capacity to see you in person should the need arise. So there have been changes in who's delivering psychotherapy, changes also in how long the sessions are, right? That's how many visits there are within an episode of care, I should say. And one of the concerns I've had for years in studying this issue is that a large proportion of people who receive psychotherapy get one visit and that's it. Now, I know there are isolated treatments that can be effective in a single session, and there's a fair amount of interest in that. So I don't want to disparage that. But as someone who studies broad trends, that's always something that's worried me. I've always felt that there are a large number of people who are prematurely terminating care. And sometimes it's because the distress may pass, but sometimes it just isn't meeting their needs, or other things occur. And so we've seen that the number of sessions during this whole period of expansion is also growing. You put this together and psychotherapy is a growth industry, you know, in sort of terms of volume of care and the amount of resources, the amount of money that's expended on it.
I want to delve into this a little bit more. Some of the research that my colleagues and I have done, and others as well, has really indicated that the profession doesn't make a difference in the outcome. Licensed professional counselors and social workers achieving outcomes comparable to psychologists or psychiatrists delivering psychotherapy.
I'll defer to you here because it's not really an area of my expertise, but my sense is that, you know, there, for a number of conditions, we have evidence-based treatments that we can point to, and I'm, you know, thinking here about cognitive behavioral treatment and interpersonal psychotherapy, you know, dialectic behavior therapy and so forth. And so, and when these psychotherapies have gone up against non-specific supportive care, they've shown benefits. And so it may have more to do with this skill set and training than with the credentialing of the individual. But it's a very difficult thing to study. And, you know, it's a very expensive and time-consuming thing. We don't have nearly as many studies as I wish we had. We don't even have that many studies comparing to revisit the topic we were on before, in-person versus telehealth. I think the balance of evidence there suggests that for many conditions that are comparable. But whether there are exceptions to that and what those exceptions are, I think we're still working it out.
Today's podcast is brought to you by CarePaths EHR, a practice management and electronic health record system with integrated measurement-based care, telehealth, and HIPAA-compatible AI-assisted progress notes. Research shows that therapists can get better outcomes today through measurement-based care, and with CarePaths, that's never been easier. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about how we can help you to make your therapy better.
I think it's important to go back to this question about who's getting psychotherapy and, mm-hmm. and the mild to moderately distressed are increasing in their use of psychotherapy. And the more severely distressed, kind of stable, if I read this correctly.
Yes.
And part of that may be the workforce, as you say, but it may be a changing attitude towards psychotherapy. I mean, anecdotally, when I talk to young adults, psychotherapy is almost a necessary experience to explore and to understand, even for moderate distress. And I think in that are both encouraging. We want people to understand themselves better, lead more productive lives, and even with moderate distress, interferes with functioning. But on the other hand, we have a shortage of service available. And for many, as you say, it's maybe easier to treat those who are mild or moderately distressed than it is severely distressed. So thoughts about those trends in terms of the availability of providers and services, but also in the attitudes towards psychotherapy.
Yeah. I think, these are very interesting and provocative issues, and they've been with us for a long time. You know, you can go back many years, and people have noted that the characteristics of the people who are, you know, receiving psychotherapy. You know, Dr. Schofield's work many, many years ago, and I guess even, you know, Redlich's work even before that in New Haven, pointing out differences in the kinds of treatments that more severe and less severe ill people receive. And so these sort of stratifications have been with us. And there, you know, it gets us into thinking about what are the barriers or what are the impediments that are preventing people who are in need from receiving care. And they're complicated. And they don't and they're very difficult to address. Some of them, like some of the geographic barriers, maybe telehealth can make some real inroads on. But still, for many people, there are big financial barriers and many private insurance companies don't offer the kind of coverage, or their panels aren't as robust as they're advertised, and there aren't people that are available that can see them without a long wait list. And so there are sort of local shortages that are compounded by financial barriers. And then, as you point out, on top of that, there are attitudinal barriers. There still is, in large segments of our society, although things have changed very rapidly among young people, there still is a considerable stigma around receiving mental health care. And I think it also is getting in the way, slowing, you know, the flow of people into care that they need. I wish I had a solution to these issues. I don't.
Two of the big ones that you mentioned, I mean, there's stigma, and that is a issue that's difficult to overcome.
Yeah.
People don't want to see a shrink, right, whether it's medication or psychotherapy. But there's the access. I mean, your survey showed those people with private insurance are going to have more access than those people without.
Well, whatever the issues around stigma, you know, is an insight that a colleague of mine, Bruce Link, had many years ago, which is that that stigma is also a reflection of broader public attitudes toward mental health and toward distress and mental health conditions. And it's when people develop the problems themselves, if they have these stigmatized attitudes about others, they turn them on themselves, and it prevents them from reaching out for the help and support that they need during their time of need. So I really almost think that it's a problem that progress will be made if it's addressed broadly, you know, reaching down into how people are educated about mental health problems and about the value that psychotherapy and other modalities offer.
Well, I always joke that, it's not true anymore, but there was a period when it was difficult to watch TV and not see advertisements for antidepressant medication.
Oh, yes.
We've never had anywhere near that, of course, advertisements for psychotherapy. So the benefits of psychotherapy, how does it work, who is it indicated for, and so forth.
And I think just how satisfied people who stick with it are, I don't think that that's appreciated either, that, you know, those stories aren't told. We have all kinds of stories of people's mood shifts. Like you say, there's a whole, literally an industry around pharmaceutical sales, as there is around regulation. I mean, that's the other thing, is that medications are more heavily regulated and they're than is psychotherapy. And I think that's sort of the flip side of the issue.
So there was a trend, particularly with the advent of SSRIs, for people to receive medication for most common mental disorders, anxiety and depression. You saw a large rise in the use of medications, many prescribed by primary care physicians. So the kind of use of medication versus psychotherapy kind of turned towards the medication side. Is that changing? Is psychotherapy regaining market share compared to medication?
You know, it's a remarkable thing. I've been interested in the rise of the use of medications really since the time that SSRIs appeared many years ago in the late 1980s. And they've had an incredible run. There's been a real ascendancy of psychotropic medications in their use in the United States, led by antidepressants. But now, in the last few years, we're seeing something we haven't seen really in recent memory, which is that psychotherapy is actually growing at a faster rate than our use of prescribed psychotropic medications. And which isn't to say that they've equaled or that psychotherapy has surpassed medications. It's still the case, if you broadly think about mental health care, that many more people are receiving medications who aren't receiving psychotherapy. But the gap is narrowing. And that's something I wouldn't have predicted a few years ago. I wouldn't have seen how that could even possibly be. But this confluence of factors that we're talking about, this expansion through teletherapy, bringing into the provision of psychotherapy a huge group of people who have less formal training, but as you point out, may well have the skills to be able to provide psychotherapy that's effective. And so the balance has tipped, and our early indications, just from looking at, you know, data from 2022 and 2023, we don't have data from last year yet, is that this change is surviving the pandemic, which is there's still an interest in psychotherapy that's rising, and there's still a substantial number of people out there who would like to receive psychotherapy, but for its costs. And so it tells me that there's still sort of running room, in the sense that there are people that are still within reach if we can find out a way to finance their kids and, you know, and support and subsidize the financing of their care.
Yeah, availability of psychotherapy is clearly an issue. I know in Madison, where I live, to find a therapist with openings is a
very
difficult proposition.
Right. Yeah. Right. It's also true that, you know, one of the advantages that medications have in this, and not to pit them against each other, but that people sort of, they can read about and they can learn about what they're getting. Very hard for people who aren't in the field to learn about therapists and learn about whether that would be the skill set of the therapist or matches the kinds of challenges that they're facing. So there, in addition to just finding someone, there's finding someone who's likely to be able to help the individual is a kind of a challenge within that.
Yeah, it is an interesting phenomenon that, you know, I'm a psychologist, so I know what's involved.
Oh, sure.
But most people do not understand psychotherapy. They go, they get an experience with one therapist, and therapists vary dramatically in the treatments they use, in their personal styles, and also in their effectiveness.
Right.
So the education about therapy is needed. Jerome Frank, decades ago, showed that pre-therapy education improved outcomes.
Yeah.
What goes on in therapy? How is it helpful?
Yeah.
What's the role of the therapist? What's the role of the patient in making this work?
Early, I tell a personal story. Early on in my training, one of my first mentors was Jerome Frank's daughter, Julia Frank. She made an impression on me, and I remember reading her father's work years ago and being impressed at how he had sort of put his finger on these common elements or non-specific factors, building up credibility and trust and the healing context and its setting, the structure of the relationship, making people feel more confident and in control. And that, so above and beyond sort of the specific skills that we put so much emphasis on now that the therapists learn, that there are these other factors that may cut across, different schools of psychotherapy that are underneath that, that are at work, which I thought as a young psychiatrist, very interesting to learn about.
So. Yeah. Yeah. Well said. And I'll put in a plug for the podcast because I just interviewed Julia.
Oh.
Because she and I revised Persuasion and Healing.
Oh, you did? Oh, yes, their landmark book. Very good.
Yeah, just came out. So it's a chance to plug our work together. And in the interview with her, one of the objectives was to talk about her father and how he came to understand psychotherapy in that way. So, interesting. I want to return to this idea of dropout. And as you mentioned, it's a concerning problem. We know that the biggest dropout prematurely is after the first session. And it's a failure to engage the patient in what they think is going to be a meaningful experience. And the second most frequent time is after the second session. So it's a waste of resources, obviously, because somebody's using resources that seemingly are not producing desired benefit. And again, some people do find benefits in one or two sessions. But many of these people are dropping out before they've really engaged in a process to make progress. So from a resource standpoint, but also from a treatment standpoint, somebody who's doesn't get the needed help from a therapist is unlikely to go back to psychotherapy again because they've had that failure experience or at least a non-productive experience.
Yeah. You've said it very well. And I think it's one of the reasons that therapists, skilled seasoned therapists are so put such a value on termination work is because they're also thinking about the future for that patient and keeping the channel and the doors open should the needs arise again. And, there's what people experience in their first session, I imagine varies a great deal. This isn't something I've studied. But I would imagine there are a lot of settings in which a lot of that first session is consumed with standardized checklists of various kinds, and the client or the patient doesn't have an opportunity to really feel heard in any sense.
Yeah.
Because there isn't time within it, because it's taken up with these more clinical administrative things. And so it's always a thought I've had is that maybe that sort of contributing to
it's a very important thought, Mark. My colleague in Australia, Daryl Chow, wrote a book about this.
Oh, I see.
We fail to engage the patient because we're going through kind of the diagnostic hierarchy and various checklists and so forth. When this is a person who's suffering and wants to feel understood and feel like there's a plan that might help them. Of course, in the first session, you don't know everything you need to know to help that patient. But there has to be, and Jerome Frank wrote about this as well and others, that there's this hopefulness that what this activity will be is going to be helpful to me.
And it's golden. It can be communicated, you know.
You know, what really strikes me here is what we need is a confluence of the kind of epidemiological work you're doing, as well as a study of what happens in naturalistic settings at kind of on the ground level, because the convergence of those two endeavors, I think, is reveal what we need to know.
I agree with you.
To improve. I mean, we work on our silos, Mark.
No, we do. We do. And, you know, and doing mixed methods research that has a qualitative and a quantitative component that are integrated, that are informing one another, in this area, as in so many, would be so valuable. Of course, now we've entered a period where funding is going to be a real challenge, and we're going to be looking increasingly. Yeah. I mean, I'm feeling this acutely at Columbia, I can tell you. But but I think there's real wisdom in what you put your finger on there.
I want to know what the evidence is, and maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but about multiple episodes of care, primarily psychotherapy, over the life course. So some people have criticized psychotherapy because it's not really a cure. People return to psychotherapy later. And I try to make the argument that mental distress is often more like a chronic disorder. Diabetes, we continue to get care over the life course. And it should be encouraged for people to come to therapy during crises. They have some event in their life or some personal struggle to receive a second episode of psychotherapy. What's the kind of evidence about multiple episodes of psychotherapy over the life course?
It's not an area that I know about. But you raise a very interesting issue. I do know that, and this may or may not intersect with the issues you're raising, is that if you follow populations over a long enough period of time, you do it prospectively. So you instead of asking them to review their life, you know, and tell you about the different periods of symptoms that they've experienced, you find a much larger proportion of people have had at least one period of their lives where they've actually met criteria for depression or for an anxiety disorder. And so that our notion of what the lifetime risk is, which is built up from people interviewing people in their 40s, say, and saying, well, you know, have you ever felt this or ever experienced this, is actually much lower than it is, suggesting that that most of us, during some point of our lives, have a need for psychotherapy. And whether we receive it or not, of course, you know, it varies on and depends upon a lot of the things we've talked about this afternoon. But thinking about this as that people have vulnerabilities that just as their lives unfold that appear, and it just gives a different perspective than thinking about a small and well-defined group who you know, needs continuous treatment. I think that is true, but I think that there's a much larger group for whom at some point in their lives they are in periods, and you know, they're living through things that have really interfered with their functioning in a way that, and it's really impaired the quality of their lives in ways that they can't kind of get themselves out of without professional help.
And not only that, but they learn something about themselves and how they respond to stressors that gives them skills to confront additional challenges in life. As we know, we all confront some kind of challenge periodically during the lifespan. I mean, there's a variety of events. And to learn something. Yep. I mean, the relapse rate we know for psychotherapy is less than it is for medication, because medications, we typically don't learn a coping strategy or a way to react to these challenges.
That's right. That's right. We don't take that with them. And the medications, for example, in depression can lift your mood, but they can't resolve the conflicts or transitions or issues that led to the episode to begin with.
Well, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the future. So it's hard to ignore, both for the lay public and for professionals, the use of electronic solutions. I mean, I think there's 10,000 mental health apps for your phone that you could look at in the stores. We know there's protocols for various therapies, guided and unguided. And then, of course, there's now AI bots that can provide therapy. I just read a clinical trial comparing bot therapy to a waitlist control. So is this a solution to our mental health needs? Are we going to be in a brave new world where these electronic solutions will be a changing event in terms of mental health care?
Well, you know, it is. It's an area that has just really exploded over the last few years, and I haven't stayed on top of it. I'm not essentially, both my daughters are child psychiatrists. They can tell you more about this than I can. It may be partly generational, but I think it's worth sort of distinguishing a few different levels of different kinds of technology. And there are technologies, that are adjuncts to psychotherapy. Some of them, like biofeedback, have been around for a while, and they're integrated into the therapy. The therapist uses the information, uses the response as part of the overall, therapeutic armamentarium. Then there are technologies that are kind of guided by therapists, right? And like virtual reality is sometimes used to help people overcome phobias, where the therapist is actually working with the program to manipulate it in a way that it exposes the patient to stress or to stimuli that allows them to work through it and so forth. And then there are the things that you're referring to, which are these fully automated interventions, which operate autonomously from therapists, and people can download and or communicate with them. And, I'd be interested in the article you've read, because when I looked at this a few months ago, I couldn't find clinical trials on those fully automated ones, which are the ones that I think are the most paradigm shifting. The trials that I found, I should say, weren't of actual people with psychiatric disorders, where they're well characterized of having met criteria, say, for depression or for one of the anxiety disorders. So while they may evolve to a point where they're able to provide use to those populations, I haven't seen the evidence yet. I'm also aware that these fully automated interventions pose real risks. They pose challenges, in terms of if there are, suicidal symptoms or psychotic symptoms, other serious symptoms that require prompt human intervention, they can't deliver. There may be privacy issues, there may be cultural biases and so forth. So there's still a long way to go before we're in a position to say with confidence that they can replace this or that function that is currently being done with at least some therapist's input. But the world is changing very quickly. And so what I'm saying now is, in a short period of time, may be outmoded. But it's my own sense that what what good therapists offer is would be exceedingly difficult to have delivered autonomously by any AI generated thing, because they're not in contact with the patient. They're responding to sequences of words, which is not, and people are, there's, you know, communication occurs in a more complex way than simply the words that we string together.
Well, we know from a lot of literature that loneliness is a risk factor for not just mental health, but physical health
as well.
And one of the things we do in psychotherapy is have this intense personal relationship. But then, as you say, it is a changing world, and many people have relationships with bots of various kinds in different ways. I mean, it's quite remarkable. I mean, we do know that, for instance, in the CBT internet protocols, the alliance with the person who's guiding the therapy behind the scenes makes a difference.
Yes.
So this alliance with the program and with the person who's guiding the therapy, I don't quite know what to call them. They could be therapists, but they could be paraprofessionals as well. But that relationship is important. And the other observation that I make is, you know, a long time ago, John Norcross reviewed bibliotherapy, right?
Yes, yes.
Bibliotherapy is effective. Well, if people can find health delivery modalities that are helpful, more power to them.
Yeah.
This is a good thing. We're not, as your research and we all know, there's going to be enough patients for all of us, regardless of how successful the electronic solutions will be. So I get off on my pet peeves as well on this. Yeah. Well, in terms of mental health services generally, you know, what trends do you see that are both concerning and hopeful, do you think?
Yeah. You know, I guess as I've outlined, I think one of my concerns is that it's still the case that large, you know, that for the common, more severe conditions, we're only reaching about half of the people in our society. And those that we're reaching often after long delays where people have lived with their symptoms for a long time and they've taken their toll on individuals. So, you know, accelerating access, improving access, those themes that have been with us for many years are still with us despite all of the advents and the expansion of psychotherapy over the last few years, and despite all of the new technologies. And I do worry considerably about groups that are being left behind, and groups that have that are already facing socioeconomic disadvantages of many kinds, that compound the problems they face and also make the services less accessible to them. So issues of equity are foremost in my thinking there. On the other hand, I do think there's room for, there is, despite the sort of cutbacks we're staring down with federal funding for research, we've still, over the years, we've learned a great deal about what kinds of psychotherapies work for whom. And so if given an opportunity to apply that knowledge, I think there's real hope and opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're facing challenges in the next years, both in terms of research, but also in funding for mental health and the priorities that's given to mental health. I mean, this is a perennial challenge, as you well know. But despite the fact that more people are desiring and accessing psychotherapy, as you say, there's various populations being left behind. And I would add to this, the quality of the service are variable. So, you know, in the surveys, you measure access to treatment, but not the quality or the effects of that treatment. And that concerns me as well. I mean, again, anecdotally, I hear case studies of what I would say is substandard treatment. And I'd like to see not only the quantity, but the quality of mental health services improve.
Well, I think that, you know, in academic medical centers, it's certainly the case that the kind of models of care have put constraints on time in a way that they didn't a generation ago. And that has to come out in terms of lower quality care. That's
Yeah, we didn't talk about the pressure to treat people in limited number of sessions, regardless of the disorder and the other constraints that our healthcare system exerts on quality. Yeah. Mark, this has been tremendously interesting and informative. I want to thank you for spending this hour with us.
Well, I'm delighted I accepted the opportunity and invitation to come. I've learned a great deal from speaking with you. So thank you for having me.
Great. Thank you very much.
Okay, that concludes this very special episode of the Making Therapy Better podcast with Bruce Wampold. We hope you'll stay tuned for the rest of season 3. We have a lot of exciting guests coming up and can't wait to share that with you every other Wednesday morning on wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, today's podcast was brought to you by CarePaths EHR. Are you a clinical supervisor or do you run a training clinic? CarePaths is a comprehensive electronic health record system built with you in mind. Research shows that therapists get better outcomes and improve more over the course of their careers when they regularly measure their clients' treatment progress and experiences in therapy and then discuss those measures collaboratively. Along with a host of other features, CarePaths makes it easy for therapists to integrate measurement-based care into their practice with just a few clicks. Head over to carepaths.com now to learn more about our EHR system designed with training clinics in mind and join us on the path toward making therapy better. Thanks so much for joining us. Take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. We hope to see you next time.